was angry. The thought of giving the bellman a 10 instead of the usual buck and then asking the fellow a few questions had certainly crossed his mind. He knew that Roger had done it on occasion. I'm going to be too busy for anything like that. What does the ad say? There's always room for Jell-O. Are you trying to make me mad, Donna, or what? No, go on and eat. You've got to feed the machine. She sat down with a waffle of her own. No oleo for her. A dash of Vermont-made syrup, that was all. How well we know each other, he thought. What time are you picking Roger up? She asked him. After some hot negotiations, we've settled on 6. She smiled again, but this time the smile was warm and fond. He really took that early bird business to heart at some point, didn't he? Yeah, I'm surprised he hasn't called yet to make sure I'm up. The phone rang. They looked at each other across the table, and after a silent, considering pause, they both burst out laughing. It was a rare moment, certainly more rare than the careful lovemaking in the dark the night before. He saw how fine her eyes were, how lucent. They were as gray as the morning mist outside. "Get it quick before it wakes the tatter up," she said. He did. It was Roger. He assured Roger that he was up, dressed, and in a fighting frame of mind. He would pick Roger up on the dot of 6. He hung up, wondering if he would end up telling Roger about Donna and Steve Kemp. Probably not. Not because Roger's advice would be bad, it wouldn't be. But even though Roger would promise not to tell Althea, he most certainly would. And he had a suspicion that Althea would find it difficult to resist sharing out such a juicy bit of bridge table gossip. Such careful consideration of the question made him feel depressed all over again. It was as if, by trying to work out the problem between them, he and Donna were burying their own body by moonlight. "Good old Roger," he said, sitting down again. He tried on a smile, but it felt wrong. The moment of spontaneity was gone. "Will you be able to get all of your stuff and all of Roger's into the Jag?" "Sure," he said. "We'll have to. Althea needs their car, and you've got..." "Oh, shit, I completely forgot to call Joe Camber about your Pinto." "You had a few other things on your mind," she said. There was faint irony in her voice. "That's all right. I'm not going to send Tad to the playground today. He has the sniffles. I may keep him home the rest of the summer, if that suits you. I get into trouble when he's gone." There were tears choking her voice, squeezing it and blurring it, and he didn't know what to say or how to respond. He watched helplessly as she found a Kleenex, blew her nose, wiped her eyes. "Whatever," he said, shaken. "Whatever seems best." He rushed on. "Just give Camber a call. He's always there, and I don't think it would take him 20 minutes to fix it, even if he has to put in another carb." "Will you think about it while you're gone?" she asked. "About what we're going to do, the two of us?" "Yes," he said. "Good, I will too. Another waffle?" "No, thanks." The whole conversation was turning surreal. Suddenly he wanted to be out and gone. Suddenly the trip felt very necessary and very attractive. The idea of getting away from the whole mess, putting miles between him and it. He felt a sudden jab of anticipation. In his mind he could see the Delta jet cutting through the unraveling fog and into the blue. "Can I have a waffle?" They both turned around, startled. It was Tad, standing in the hallway in his yellow footy pajamas, his stuffed coyote grasped by one ear, his red blanket wrapped around his shoulders. He looked like a small, sleepy Indian. "I guess I could rustle one up," Donna said, surprised. Tad was not a notably early riser. "Was it the phone, Tad?" Vic asked. Tad shook his head. "I made myself wake up early so I could say goodbye to you, Daddy. Do you really have to go?" "It's just for a while." "It's too long," Tad said blackly. "I put a circle around the day you're coming home on my calendar. Mom showed me which one. I'm going to mark off every day. And she said she'd tell me the monster words every night." "Well, that's okay, isn't it?"
"Will you call?"
"Every other night," Vic said.
"Every night,"
Tad insisted. He crawled up into Vic's lap and set his coyote next to Vic's plate. Tad began to crunch up a piece of toast.
"Every night, Daddy."
"I can't every night," Vic said, thinking of the back-breaking schedule Roger had laid out on Friday before the letter had come.
Why not?
Because your Uncle Roger is a hard taskmaster, Donna said, putting Tad's waffle on the table. Come on over here and eat. Bring your coyote. Daddy will call us tomorrow night from Boston and tell us everything that happened to him. Tad took his place at the end of the table. He had a large plastic placemat that said, Tad.
Will you bring me a toy?
Maybe, if you're good. And maybe I'll call tonight so you'll know I got to Boston in one piece.
Good deal.
Vic watched, fascinated, as Tad poured a small ocean of syrup over his waffle.
What kind of toy?
We'll see, Vic said. He watched Tad eat his waffle. It suddenly occurred to him that Tad liked eggs. Scrambled, fried, poached, or hard-boiled, Tad gobbled them up. Tad?
What, Daddy?
If you wanted people to buy eggs, what would you tell them?
Tad considered.
I'd tell them eggs taste good, he said. Vic met his wife's eyes again, and they had a second moment like the one that had occurred when the phone rang. This time they laughed telepathically. Their goodbyes were light. Only Tad, with his imperfect grasp of how short the future really was, cried.
You'll think about it?
Donna asked him again as he climbed into the Jag. Yes. But driving into Bridgeton to get Roger, what he thought about were those two moments of near-perfect communication. Two in one morning, not bad. All it took was 8 or 9 years together, roughly a quarter of all the years so far spent on the face of the earth. He got thinking about how ridiculous the whole concept of human communication was, what monstrous, absurd overkill was necessary to achieve even a little. When you'd invested the time and made it good, you had to be careful. Yes, he'd think about it. It had been good between them, and although some of the channels were now closed, filled with God knew how much muck, and some of that muck might still be squirming, plenty of the others seemed open and in reasonably good working order. There had to be some careful thought, but perhaps not too much at once. Things had a way of magnifying themselves. He turned the radio up and began to think about the poor old sharp serial professor. Joe Camber pulled up in front of the Greyhound terminal in Portland at 8:10. The fog had burned off, and the digital clock atop the Casco Bank and Trust read 73 degrees already. He drove with his hat planted squarely on his head, ready to be angry at anyone who pulled out or cut in front of him. He hated to drive in the city. When he and Gary got to Boston, he intended to park the car and leave it until they were ready to come home. They could take the subways if they could puzzle them out, walk if they couldn't. Charity was dressed in her best pantsuit. It was a quiet green, and a white cotton blouse with a ruffle at the neck. She was wearing earrings, and this had filled Brett with a mild sense of amazement. He couldn't remember his mother wearing earrings at all, except at church. Brett had caught her alone when she went upstairs to dress after getting Dad his breakfast oatmeal. Joe had been mostly silent, grunting answers to questions in monosyllables, then shutting off conversation entirely by tuning the radio to WCSH for the ball scores. They were both afraid that the silence might presage a ruinous outburst and a sudden change of mind on their trip. Charity had the slacks of her pantsuit on and was slipping into her blouse. Brett noted she was wearing a peach-colored bra, and that had also amazed him. He hadn't known his mother had underclothes in any color other than white. Ma, he said urgently. She turned to him. It seemed almost that she was turning on him.
Did he say something to you?
No. It's Cujo.
Cujo? What about Cujo?
He's sick.
What do you mean, sick? Brett told her about having his second bowl of Cocoa Bears out on the back steps, about walking into the fog, and how Cujo had suddenly appeared, his eyes red and wild, his muzzle dripping foam.
And he wasn't walking right, Brett finished. He was kind of, you know, staggering. I think I better tell Daddy.
No, his mother said fiercely, and grasped him by the shoulders hard enough to hurt. You do no such a thing. He looked at her, surprised and frightened. She relaxed her grip a little and spoke more quietly.
He just scared you coming out of the fog like that. There's probably nothing wrong with him at all, right?
Brett groped for the right words to make her understand how terrible Cujo had looked, and how for a moment he had thought the dog was going to turn on him. He couldn't find the words. Maybe he didn't want to find them.
If there is something wrong, Charity continued,
It's probably just some little thing. He might have gotten a dose of skunk.
I didn't smell any skunk.
Or he might have been running a woodchuck or a rabbit. Might even have jumped a moose down there in that bog. Or he might have eaten some nettles.
I guess he could have,
Brett said doubtfully. Your father would just jump on something like that, she said. I can hear him now. Sick, is he? Well, he's your dog, Brett. You see to him. I got too much work to do to be messing around with your mutt. Brett nodded unhappily. It was his own thought, exactly, magnified by the brooding way his father had been eating breakfast while the sports blared around the kitchen. If you just leave him, he'll come mooching around your dad, and your dad will take care of him, Charity said. He loves Cujo almost as much as you do, although he'd never say it. If he sees something's wrong, he'll fetch him over to the vet in South Paris.
Yeah, I guess he would.
His mother's words rang true to him, but he was still unhappy about it. She bent and kissed his cheek.
I'll tell you, we can call your father tonight if you want. How would that be?
And when you talk to him, you just say sort of casually, "You feeding my dog, Daddy?" And then you'll know.
Yeah,
Brett said. He smiled gratefully at his mother, and she smiled back, relieved, the trouble averted. But, perversely, it had given them something else to worry about during the seemingly interminable period before Joe backed the car up to the porch steps and silently began to load their four pieces of luggage into the wagon. Into one of them, Charity had surreptitiously placed all six of her snapshot albums. This new worry was that Cujo would lurch into the yard before they could drive away and stick Joe Camber with the problem. But Cujo hadn't shown up. Now Joe lowered the tailgate of the country squire, handed Brett the two small bags, and took the two large ones for himself. "Woman, you got so much luggage, I wonder if you ain't leaving on one of those Reno divorce cruises instead of going down to Connecticut." Charity and Brett smiled uneasily. It sounded like an attempt at humor, but with Joe Camber, you were never really sure. "That would be a day," she said. "I guess I'd just have to chase you down and drag you back with my new chainfall," he said, unsmiling. His green hat was cocked squarely on the back of his head. "Boy, you going to take care of your mom?" Brett nodded. "Yeah, you better," he measured the boy. "You're getting pretty damn big. Probably you ain't got a kiss to give your old man."
"I guess I do, Daddy,"
Brett said. He hugged his father tight and kissed his stubbly cheek, smelling sour sweat and a phantom of last night's vodka. He was surprised and overwhelmed by his love for his father, a feeling that sometimes still came, always when it was least expected, but less and less often over the last 2 or 3 years, something his mother did not know and would not have believed if told. It was a love that had nothing to do with Joe Camber's day-to-day behavior toward him or his mother. It was a brute biological thing that he would never be free of, a phenomenon with many illusory reference of the sort which haunt for a lifetime. The smell of cigarette smoke, the look of a double-edged razor reflected in a mirror, pants hung over a chair, certain curse words. His father hugged him back and then turned to Charity. He put a finger under her chin and turned her face up a little. From the loading bays behind the squat brick building, they heard a bus warming up. Its engine was a low and guttural diesel rumble. "Have a good time," he said. Her eyes filled with tears, and she wiped them away quickly. The gesture was nearly one of anger. "Okay," she said. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.